Today is Thursday, August 24th, 2023. This is part 20 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N, last name M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing just fine.
Great. Glad to hear it. Alan, yesterday, you gave us a wonderful recounting of how you refurbished, basically took apart and put all back together, the building known as Samantha's Cabin. There's another building there called the Leo Weaver Building. Did you work on that building? You mentioned the paint. You worked on the paint on the outside of that building. What else did you do there?
Yeah, I did a lot and ended up spending several months working on that building. The only thing I'll say before we go, the Samantha, the major reconstruction was done by the park crews that came in, you know, were contracted to come in and renovate the buildings. I spent, you know, several months, like on Samantha's Cabin, with all the little details, which they couldn't do. So they need the major credit. I did a lot of little things to finish it off, and I was happy with that. So, but let me talk about the Weaver Ranch House. After the ferry was gone, the bridge, Navajo Bridge, was constructed. The family that, the last family to own the whole Lonely Dell Ranch, and I'd have to look up their name again. They're only part of the history. They owned the place for several years and didn't destroy very much. That was the good part. But anyway, in the mid-30s, Leo and his wife, Weaver, ran a dude ranch at south of Flagstaff for the summer traffic, and they had people mainly from California coming into their dude ranch.
Okay.
And in the winter, they couldn't use it. They found that the place that Lonely Dell was for sale, they went up there and purchased it as a winter dude ranch.
Okay.
So their plan was to summer in Flagstaff and winter at Lee's Ferry.
Okay.
Which I have to say was smart move. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But then he was quite a character, and there's a very, you know, strong history, especially in P.T. Riley's book. He has a long section about the Weavers and what they did and didn't do, and this positive and weird things and whatever. But one of the first things he had to do when they got there was to build a ranch house for his dude ranch.
Okay.
They moved into the old schoolhouse, which was above, right, couple, maybe 50 yards north of the buildings today, which it's no longer there, but that the Johnsons had, and Emmett had the school there several years. But then they made plans. Part of the problem was that their clientele, some that were very, just couldn't wait to see this new development, and they kept showing up before he was ready for them, but some of them stayed in the Samantha cabin, and he and his wife were up in the schoolhouse. But he started work in the fall of 1935 to build a ranch house. And he hired a contractor from Hopi land, a Hopi Indian contractor. Last name is Hungapovi. And you can get that name out of D.T. Riley's book if you want. But he and his family, meaning extended family, too, came up and worked with Weaver to build, and they ended up building the first half of the building, which was the kitchen, living room, and great room. And it has the stone walls around it now when you look at it. And they, Weaver did some good things in the building and some that were incredibly bizarre, but they built it, you know, to look old, like it had been there forever.
Okay.
So it was rubble stone, they call it. You build a 2x4 and 1x10s or whatever you have. Nowadays you do it with a sheet of plywood. But you put that down on the inside, and then you started work on the outside where you put down some mortar, concrete mortar, stack rocks on that, fill in between them with more mortar, stack more rocks, and build up this outside wall that looked really good, and it held together great. You'd fill in the inside with rubbles, I'd say, just broken pieces or small rocks that were left over, and then you'd take the and you kind of press it against the 2x or 1x on the inside.
Okay.
So when you took that wooden thing off inside, you had this basically concrete wall, relatively smooth. And they'd fill in any of the gaps that happened to be on the inside. But then they would stucco the wall with a concrete, regular modern stucco, doing it pretty broad strokes so it looked kind of old and
okay.
Everything.
What would they do for the floor? Was the floor dirt, or would they do a concrete
floor
there?
Is coming.
Okay.
Floor was
so coming. So they didn't do the floor first. They did this.
No.
They basically used the 2x4s and the 1x10s as a concrete form, if you will.
Yes. Yes.
And they leaned. They must have leaned the outer walls in a little bit toward that wall, toward that inner wall,
right,
so it wouldn't fall over when they built it.
Yeah, and it was on a pretty good foundation there. The building has survived very, very well.
Okay.
And if you go down there and you look in the end of the west end of the building where people normally go in, if you look at the walls there, you can see exactly how the rest of the building was built, because they didn't finish that out there. That was more for a utility room and a mud room, we'd call it today. But
okay.
Anyway, they did that. They put a flooring of 2x8s across there of floor joists, and they held them up with one or two sandstone stones.
Okay.
And the turned out that there was no crawl space because of the under the floor joists, it wasn't 2 inches, maybe 3 or 4 in places.
Okay.
But it was those were on the little stone piers.
Got it. So the 2x8 floor joists were not resting on the ground. They were resting on these little pieces of sandstone.
Right. Well, they were like 1 foot square pieces of sandstone. But it was not much of a footing. And it was the same on the walls, though they kind of concreted. They left a little ledge on the inside wall there to set the floor joists on.
Okay.
And then they covered the floors with a 1x8s or 10s, whatever it was. And all this lumber was being hauled from Flagstaff from the Babbitt Mills and Babbitt Lumber Company, because he ended up really in debt to Babbitt Brothers. And they then made a subflooring of tongue and grooved about 1x8s or different widths, and that was put on as at a diagonal to the floor joists. And that became the subflooring. Then they completely covered that with ponderosa prime not softwood flooring, it was saying.
So was that clear fir they were using?
It was all from Flagstaff.
Right.
We had it checked, and it was ponderosa pine. It was milled specially for them, or maybe they had enough that they provided that at the lumber yard in Flagstaff.
So okay.
It looks like modern oak flooring, but it's really ponderosa pine.
So do you see any knots in it?
No.
Right.
Very, almost, I'd say no knots. There might have been one or two that were small, but
okay.
Not really any. Then they put the 2x8s or sixes, probably 2x6s across for the ceiling joists on top of the concrete walls, and they built the sloped roof, regular hip roof, and that was covered with the 1x10s and 12s again. That in this today, if you can even get them, they're a fortune to buy a clear 1x12. And on top of that, they put the tar paper.
Okay.
And that was the basically the way the building was constructed. It had, well, eventually it had electricity, not during the Weaver time at all. They finished that, what we call the West Wing, with the kitchen, dining room, and great room, living room, in the spring of 36. Everyone packed up and went back to Hopi Land or to Flagstaff, and they had a season. In the place they rented south of Flagstaff. And then in the fall of 36, Weaver and his family came back to build the East Wing, which was three bedrooms. The Angapavi never came back. I don't know if it was a matter of money, because Weaver really didn't have enough to really build this thing. And he was a very poor businessman. He could talk people into loaning him or just flat giving him the money to build this, and he would tend to go out and buy a new pickup or something instead of using it in the construction. But many people in the end got very upset at him. So what he did, and he probably just had enough guys that were around Lewis Ferry that would put in some work with him. They built, well, what they did was took down the schoolhouse right there and used all the lumber to build the three bedrooms in the east wing of it. And the other interesting thing is that P.T. Riley found out and was confirmed that in the building of the Navajo Bridge, the big concrete abutments and all, the Johnson family at Lee's Ferry got the contract to provide and basically to remove all the forms on the concrete there on the bridge. And the family joke was that an awful lot of that lumber that came back to the ranch and was used in that schoolhouse did not have concrete stains on it. Meaning, well, they were just basically saying that that bench case, you know, they did the work that ADOT wanted down there, and they got what they wanted, which was enough lumber to build a schoolhouse.
Okay.
But the lumber in the frame of the and the walls of the east end of the ranch house was from the school. When we renovated that and took off the interior walls, there was the ubiquitous it's 1x12 across there. And the outside is a clapboard that was definitely that age and looked, you know, very different, but it's why came that circuitous route from school to the bridge. And that's just the way they worked back then. You didn't throw lumber away.
Right.
Used it again and again and again.
It's but interesting thinking about Weaver. He's got a dining room and a kitchen. You need that. He's got a great room where people can sit around. Okay, fine. And only three bedrooms. I'm assuming he and his wife are going to be in one of them. That means he can only have two paying customer groups at a time.
Right.
Not financially.
That was the start. And he had plans for more cabins around.
Okay.
But Dude Ranch visitors at that time would come for the season. This wasn't a one-week vacation. These were people mainly from, he bragged that they were coming from Hollywood and Palm Springs. And these couples and a couple single ladies, those older ladies would come out, and they'd spend a month or two. And really, they just were entertained at the evening. It was a very comfortable, great room. They would ride horses and go around the area there at Lee's Ferry and have picnics and were happy, I guess, because that's...
Okay. It is a beautiful area.
Yeah. And he was kind of successful with... And he was a great entertainer, I'll put that way. No question there. People had fun. But the thing I wanted to come back to the renovation is that The building was evaluated by a Park Service team from back east in about 2007 or 8. So this was a separate evaluation to all the other historic districts. And it told the whole history.
Okay.
And all the parts that needed to be repaired. No major things, so it's kind of what consists of a major renovation. But the superintendent at the time, who was very, very pro Lee's Ferry, Kitty, what was her last name? I'd have to look that up. But she really supported what I was doing, and she flat asked me, well, which of these projects that the committee came up with, which could you handle? And I told her, and so she said, go ahead. And she worked it out where my, you know, position was extended for 3 years, and my focus was on the Weaver House.
Alan?
Mainly, researching.
Hey,
yeah?
Hey, Alan, you'd mentioned, and I may have misunderstood this, that a lot of these buildings received attention in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Did the Weaver structure receive attention at that time as well?
It did, in that they, it did. But the electricity was improved.
Okay.
They put a steel roof over it, which was really a problem for historians, but.
Right.
They remodeled the three bedrooms.
Okay.
Tore down the inside, and what they made it into was, on the south side, there was a kitchen, and dining area, and a little living where you could have a sofa and all. Next to that, they took the middle bedroom and made it the kitchen area, and the other half of it was made into a bathroom, a modern bathroom, and then there was the one bedroom left. And the idea was that interpreters, maintenance, whatever in the future, could live there. It would be park housing.
Okay.
For the one thing, it would be, they didn't have to build a house from scratch, but they also, it would provide the presence on the ranch and protection, because everything that wasn't tied down walked off as it got, open to the public more. And so for several years, park people lived in that, individuals or single couples.
Okay.
And you'll have to ask, but I'm sure that Lisa Rebell and her husband were one of the first to live there.
Oh, really? Okay.
And that's before she was injured.
That's Lisa Rydell and Pat Horning.
Pat Horning, yeah. He was working there for maintenance.
Okay.
And I'm sure he was one of the first.
Okay.
And several others lived in that thing. So now you've got the outside of the building is, as it was built by Weaver, and inside it was more or less the way the last owners had it, and they had kept most of the Weaver furniture, and it looks much the same. In fact, good pictures of what it looked like.
Okay.
But the thing I want to talk about is that you would never know, because I don't know if they even mentioned this, but a guy, well, I had medical issues about this time, and I then was back to work with a kind of a limited, doctor said I could, but everyone said, watch out, don't do what you used to do, but they park-hired Scott Dolinar, who was working for the maintenance up in Wawee, and he really wanted to come down there and help. And we worked together for the next couple years on the Weaver House.
So, how do you spell Scott's last name?
Let's see, D-O-L-I-N-A-R. Oh, there's an I in there. D-O-L-I-N-A-R. Dolinar. Really good fellow.
Okay.
But our first, over the years, I had been doing little ones like the lead paint abatement and what I could do. But we decided to really make a full renovation of the start at the kitchen.
Okay.
And there was an issue because the kitchen floor sloped in really strange ways. It wasn't flat at all. And we took off the flooring, tried to save it, but it turned out there's some dry termites that ate into the very top inch or so of the flooring.
Oh, wow.
But didn't get into the base, the subflooring or the joist down there.
Okay.
So we couldn't save that. We really tried, but we took off all the subflooring. And to our amazement, what had happened, really, was one of the archaeologist's famous catastrophic collapse. The whole kitchen end of the building had collapsed.
Oh, wow.
The deal was that it was only 2 inches deep under there, and so it just settled down 1 to 2 inches.
So the floor and its joists and everything just settled, or walls of the structure, or was it just the flooring?
Just the floor and the there were a bunch of pillars in the kitchen there, but we couldn't figure out what was going on. But to make the long story short, when I went up in the attic, which I had to antivirus cover, and cleaning up, there was this, what I'd been through in all the buildings. There was dirt up there, an inch or two deep, full of rat stuff and squirrels and ringtail cats up on the ceiling. But when I got that basically cleaned off and I kept cleaning and digging and digging, it turned out that there was 6 inches of dirt on top of the ceiling.
Whoa.
That had been put there by Weaver.
Okay.
And to this day, architects and builders have debated what possessed them to put this. They had to really work at it.
Wouldn't that have given them insulation?
There would have been insulation, and also fire protection.
Oh.
If the ceiling caught fire, in theory, all the sand would come down and put out the ceiling. But it wasn't done in the dining room or the great room.
Huh.
It was just in the kitchen, and there was a pantry and a bathroom next to it. But The one thing that the theory that I liked is I could imagine Weaver asking Gundavati, you know, we've got to do something up on this roof here. This place is going to be hotter than blazes. And they wanted the kitchen in the house, in the modern house. They didn't want to put it out the way the pioneers lived out next door. But I can imagine Gundavati saying, well, at my house, it's stone adobe walls, and on top of that we have the big wooden vigas, the logs, and there's sticks and then brush on top of that, right. And then a foot of sand. Because if you go with the pueblos, that's exactly what they are. You can see the ends of the logs sticking out,
yep.
And if you look up under there, you can see sometimes it's just a whole bunch of brush, and other times it's really beautiful sticks that are laid out in a pattern.
Right.
But then there's a sort of dirt on top.
So what you're saying is that maybe they built the kitchen without a roof, and they used this layer of dirt as some sort of a temporary roof until they put the main roof over it?
They put the roof over it, right. They put on the ceiling, well, they had a very heavy decking up there of boards again.
And right.
Then very consciously put all that sand up there and then built the peaked roof.
Okay.
And because, and what had happened, and it probably happened right away, was the weight of the sand, just the floor collapsed. It was held up by this load-bearing wall, which was just 2x4s, and it had a major load, and they put in some new 6x6 posts, one at each end of the kitchen and two in the middle, and to hold up the ceiling. And when we took out the floor, we found these posts that were holding up everything had no piers under them. They were just sitting on
floor joists.
So Scott and I, we took the roof off the kitchen and then removed the decking in one side and then the other.
Hey, wait. You took the roof off? That means you had to remove all that dirt.
That's what we're getting to. We had to. That was our goal.
Wow.
Was if we were going to do anything in this building, in this kitchen, to restore it, we're going to have to remove the dirt.
Wow.
And all the architects.
Oh, so you took the roof off above the dirt to get to the dirt.
To get to the dirt.
That makes sense. And got it.
And then, of course, we saw all the different layers of roofing up there. And then Scott got this big front loader from while we got it down, and he'd drive it over, lift it up the scoop right next to the eave up there, and we got in the attic, which was easy. Now you could just stand up there around the rafters, which we didn't take the rafters off, and then we just shoveled for days and days.
Wow.
Shoveling out the scoop, and each scoop had a full yard of material, and we ended up taking 8 yards of material.
Wow.
And that was thousands of pounds.
Yeah.
Tons.
Wow.
Of material. The amazing thing, well, it made me feel really good when we got all that dirt out, and when it looked down on the floor foundation, it had lifted up in place.
Just by scooping the dirt out?
Just by scooping the dirt out.
Oh, my gosh.
Taking those tons and tons of stuff off, it came back up an inch or two.
Wow.
And it wasn't mm-hmm. perfect. There were still breaks where they had been broken, but you know, even if when the floor joists, they did break, but they only sat down an inch, so it wasn't a huge break. But then was covered up to put the roof back the way it was, the old layers and the new layers.
Okay.
And then came down, and fortunately I had set up Elder Hostel Road War Scholars, whatever the group is now, with Joanne and Joseph to come for 2 weeks of work on the Weaver House and several other projects around that they like doing. But it only took a day for all the weeks and weeks of my preparation, but to have these 10 guys and the ladies too with these 5-gallon paint buckets, we put some boards down, and the best thing to do was to have the paint bucket in a wheelbarrow. They shoveled the dirt out from the floor there into the buckets. So we had to make a crawl space under there, because we had to put in concrete piers.
Okay.
To be code and to really make the thing pull together and not fall down another time. So they dug down a good foot, maybe, it was more than that. It could have been 16 inches. And with this big crew of volunteers, some digging in the dirt, others pushing the wheelbarrows with the five-gallon bucket of dirt out and around back the building behind the tamarisks where I got permission to dump it.
Okay.
And like I say, the whole thing, setting it up and getting to that point, seemed like weeks and weeks.
Hmm.
And I was almost disappointed that they did it in one afternoon.
Oh, wow.
It was great. It was just fantastic. So Scott and I they dug piers so there were 12 concrete piers that we put under the kitchen, and they were dug down 2 feet.
Okay.
And we used those circular round stono tubes.
Oh, yeah, that, yeah.
Yeah, that you fill up with concrete. And he was able to get a cement mixer down, and he and I did the, filled up the piers with the sauna tubes, and then put it in the top of the brackets that would, attach, that you'd attach the floor joists to.
Right.
We built them up under, we put 3 new 4x6s under the kitchen floor joists, the old ones, and they built the piers under those, and they were bolted, the piers were bolted to those new joists. And then we came back and actually put in all new joists, except we sister-screwed them all to the original historic ones.
Okay.
And it was important to me and to the historic architect that I worked with all along in saying, you know, preserve all of the old that you can.
Okay.
So he was very positive with putting these new ones, but nailing them to the old ones.
So preserving, preserving means you don't have to use it, just keep it in place.
Just keep it there.
Got
it. Make sure it'll stay weak.
Okay.
So
all the digging you had to do to drop that floor, did you remove the historic joists and then put them back in?
No, we left them in there the whole time.
So people had to work around those joists.
Yes,
during the digging. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it was. That seemed to be. That was the best idea for us.
Okay.
And I guess we could have, but I really wanted to leave stuff in place that was historic.
Yeah. The concrete mixer. This is just a regular gas or electric powered drum that goes round and round, and you have to shovel in the
exactly.
aggregate and put in the bags of concrete and put in some water and mix it all up and then slurry it out into a bucket and carry it in there.
Right.
Okay.
So that was a lot of work, but we got it done. And this was a big cement mixer too, a lot bigger than the home owner would use.
Okay.
And then at that point, about then was when I left the Park Service, but I'll just mention that Scott continued and got the floor boards, the pine, milled in, Flagstaff, I guess. I don't know where the mill really was, but bought it from the lumber yard down there, had a special ordered and specially milled, so we had samples of what the original, and
okay.
they said, "Oh yeah, we'll do that. It'll cost,
but yeah,
we can do that."
Was that tongue and groove then?
Yes.
Okay.
It was all tongue and groove, and so he installed all of that. I wasn't there for that part of it. I know why. It was 2011, and that was when I had the third lymphoma. So
okay.
I was out of the picture for a while. I came back and put about a year in finishing up all that I had done there with cataloging all of my photographs and titling them and putting, organizing it and printing them out and publishing.
Okay.
That, but I really didn't do any more. So that was just.
Let me just go back to the kitchen area. So, once you guys had the floor joists done, you had to leave. Scott got the floor deck on. Now there's still a ceiling. Above you that has no dirt on it.
Right. Yeah, we did that too. We did that with the elder hostel that was there.
So did you guys put the dirt back?
No. The original one by is up and on top of the, there was a decking in the attic. The whole, you couldn't see any of the attic joists because there was a really nice decking up there.
Okay.
And we left that and put the waterproofing on it. But then underneath, they had used what we'd consider now really cheap fiber board paneling up there. But it came in 3x6 sheets.
Okay.
It's painted white on one side, and if you grab the corner, you could bend it and snap it off. It's so.
Huh. What were they doing with that?
They put that under on the underside of the ceiling joist to make a ceiling, and then they put 1x2s furring strips across on the joints of all of those big panels. And so it looks pretty modern and pretty nice up there, except that, you know, that's what we were restoring was basically when the park got that building. Right. And so some of the others, like Samantha's Cabin, was restored generations back from that. This was what it looked like in the 1972.
Got it.
And they painted that, and the roof was put in. And there's no plumbing. We did leave a place that you can get access the new crawl space under there in the old bathroom that was there. And when we came, the kitchen looked really good inside. There was a metal cabinet with the sink, the drain, and the cabinet doors, all one unit, about 6 feet wide. There was a modern propane stove in there, the big hood over the stove. And the other wall was a large cabinet that had counter space on top, doors with storage below, and cabinets above with storage, which really went back to the Weavers.
Right.
And
okay.
We took all of that out and stored it in the dining room, and I understand eventually it was put back.
Fortunately, okay.
Put back in the kitchen, I hope. But I think Elder Hostel helped the volunteers with putting the ceiling up, and I cleaned off the wall chip. There's a lot of chipped paint on the stucco, and we re-stuccoed that and repainted it. So a lot, was done. And folks, we're ready to, if everything had gone right, we would have then moved into the dining room, which had issues, but not the floor collapse. Decided that to get it to code, its park issue is to use the building, it has to be up to code.
Okay.
So if you have evening programs, if you have someone has a dinner there or a lecture series, whatever, the building basically has to move toward being up to code.
Okay.
One of the big issues was going to be a sprinkler system, which was down the line, but that was going to be necessary eventually. But I wasn't able to continue anymore. The park at headquarters, everyone that I worked with moved on, retired, got better positions, and moved to other parks. And so up there was a whole new staff that really had no real concept of, they heard a lot about what I was doing down there, but they kept finding more important things that need to be done in the recreation area. And, the whole thing of prioritizing and the funds and all, and they basically said Scott had to go back to Wawaweep, and he could come down there occasionally if there was something, but they basically turned off the switch there.
Oh, wow.
So there have been a couple. I have to be honest that in the last 15 years since I've been there. And the park did have a couple projects in there working on the bed, the east wing there, trying to bring it back to maybe where someone could stay there.
Okay.
But I don't think that's ever happened.
Huh. So yeah, it seems like you need one or two people with dedicated funding, not only for their salaries, but for the equipment and materials that they're going to use to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's not, if that funding isn't there, then that work isn't going to happen. It's pretty simple.
Yeah, and it's just, what do they call this? Deferred maintenance.
Right.
And they've got this huge list of millions of dollars of deferred maintenance, and it's just always somewhere down at the bottom is
that's right.
Work on Lee's Ferry.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and the architect, the archaeologist that's over it, they've tried, but again, it's a matter of getting funding, getting people that can do it, and just, they've got other things to do. So that's, I can't fault them, but it's,
For that building, for the Leo Weaver building, it sounds like you did a ton of work, though there was more to be done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
A ton of work. But, I admitted that I had to retire finally.
Okay.
And, I've always regretted where it ended up, but one thing I just remembered that I do want to mention about what I did on the Samantha's Cabin that was very important.
Oh, okay.
To me was I put in a huge vegetable garden next to it.
Oh, wow.
And it was, the irrigation ditch that watered the trees around the ranch house and the flooded the so-called lawn came right by Samantha's Cabin, and it forked going down to the, historically it went down to the orchard, and it could, due to this area that had been a big vegetable garden for everyone that lived there, because,
oh wow,
unfortunately for me, all I had to do was come up with a picture, historic, of a garden there, and everyone said, sure.
Oh, nice.
So I tilled it up, and it became obvious the footprint that wasn't on the surface at all, but there was a very dark, loamy soil.
Wow.
And immediately west of it, as the slope came down, there was just a line of gray clay, shale. So it was obvious where it was. And
so
it was a big garden, and it was very, very successful.
The line of gray clay, was that the outline of the original garden then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The gray was the clay coming off the hillside there.
Okay.
That was, people couldn't believe that anyone could grow anything there and live there. And that was one of the points, to show this magnificent garden, because everything grew like it was.
Wow.
I've been waiting 50 years, and finally some guy comes along and plants, and boy, did they go, because it had corn and beans, potatoes, asparagus, and zucchini,
okay.
Lots of squash.
Okay.
And had heirloom varieties.
Wow.
I really worked research and got it. And the corn was the most successful because I got this, probably won't remember the name of it, was Silver King or something that was very popular after the turn of the century. It's still grown in the Midwest.
Okay.
But it's a very, it's a hard, dense corn, white kernels. If you're going to be making cornmeal and the corn that's...
The blue corn?
No, not the blue corn. It's the...
like a sweet corn?
No, it's what you do with the corn afterwards. You dry it, and then when you need it, you take off the kernels, and then you soak them in lime water, and they puff up big.
Oh, and you're making grits?
Making grits. Hominy and grits.
Okay.
That's what that corn, the silver thing, is used for today, but it was popular then. And what I didn't realize, it said robust, but these, and I planted maybe 10 rows, 10, 8 or 10 feet at least, so 100 square feet of this stuff, and it grew up 10 and 12 feet tall.
Whoa!
With 3 and 4 huge ears of this white corn, and it just, I couldn't have asked for any better.
Wow.
to demonstrate, people would come around and walk up to there and say, they couldn't believe how lush the garden was because everything thrived in there.
Huh.
And I kept that up, I think, for 4 years.
Okay.
And when I think one of the interpreters tried and did a good job, but what I was trying to do was demonstrate to the park and the community and the people that were the vested, the families of the pioneers and all that this is what's possible.
Mm.
We can have this great living ranch in a way.
Well, it's interesting, Alan, because when I think of the ferry before the Navajo Bridge, during the days of livestock, wagons, and horses, there was a need for food, for alfalfa, for the stock, but I never kind of considered, well, there would have been a huge need to feed the people that were traveling through. I mean, they would have had their own food to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But
it was mainly, you're almost correct, because the families that lived there, the Johnsons and the Emmets and they really needed a big farm to support themselves.
Right.
And they had acres and acres of grass, alfalfa, and one thing they grew several acres of was sorghum.
Okay. What were they doing? Was that food for stock?
Partially. They ground it up and got the syrup and made, molasses.
Okay.
What is basically what it ends up as. But back in, and that was in Warren Johnson's time. He had a press there and made just hundreds of gallons of molasses. And the thing was, you could preserve it in a container, and they could be hauled to market in can add it was.
Okay.
You know, fresh stuff, even cheese, milk, butter, that sort of had to be consumed. You weren't going to try and take that. You know,
right.
Then, so,
but if you could sell that to the people that were coming through the ferry for the ferry business, yeah, that would be fairly lucrative, extra money to earn.
Well, it really didn't. For the whole first 10 years that Johnson's and the big wagon trains would come through, everyone knew that there were beautiful hay fields at the ranch, but that was for the Johnsons. They had horses and cows and oxen that just for their own use. And what the wagon trains would do is they would stop up beyond, they'd really stop up at House Rock Spring around the Perea of their plateau. But they would come around, and there was a lot of grassy flats before you come to Cliff Dwellers Lodge. And they would take their time there and really let the animals get all they could.
Hmm.
And because basically when they left Cliff Dwellers, there was no grazing. And they had to make a beeline to the ferry and cross and go on the other side to where Bitter Springs, where there was more feed. And there was the Lonely Dell did not provide any food for the animals.
Huh.
Some of the individual travelers, just with a horse and a pack horse or something, they could work it out with Johnson to, you know, put up the horse in the corral and feed it some hay with the other horses, but the wagon trains didn't. And there wasn't the wagons going south. They really didn't have any much money. The odd thing was that they had to pay to cross the ferry.
Right.
Even though the Mormon Church built it and operated it and had missionaries there running it, and these were colonists going to northern Arizona to settle Mormon towns. When they crossed the ferry, they paid. Wasn't much, but it was. They had to bring that with them, know that they were going to pay when they crossed the Colorado. And many times the people really hadn't planned right, and they would pay in kind. In other words, what he could take and use. And they'd, I know they'd leave a lot sacks of wheat, which made it hard for them when they were getting where they went. And I know that several left beehives, and that's why Johnson became a beekeeper.
Ah, okay.
And he had, you know, over 100 bottles of, or 100 gallons of honey every year. A lot, and it, you know, he didn't plan that. It just, people talked him into it to pay for the crossing with bees, and they didn't have time to work for him, but they, you know, having cloth for the women there, for Samantha and Cornelia, for clothing, possibly even shoes, you know, because the Johnsons, they were out there the whole year. They were isolated.
Right.
And, you know, anything they could get like that. But the trail came up through the ranch there. Most all of the wagons went right through there.
Okay.
On it. So it was for a few years there, the ranch really shined. And I spent a lot of time on the orchard, which we can talk some other time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for this review of the Weaver structure and your work there. And this garden at Samantha's Cabin. Very cool.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Maybe this is a good time to pause here. And next time we will pick up the USGS and a couple other things.
Right.
Okay. Well, with that, good. Let's conclude part 20 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Thursday, August 24th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.